Measuring yourself is easy in some respects, like your age, your height, your weight, but not so easy in others, like your character, integrity, and maturity. But those are the real measurements we should be focusing on. Your quantitative info doesn't define who you are, it's your qualitative info that does. But growth doesn't just happen. It takes intentional accountability on your part. So welcome to The Measuring Post, a place where we can learn and grow together.
Hello, welcome to another edition of The Measuring Post. I'm humbled today to be bringing somebody on that you might not be familiar with if you're not a Denver native, but this guy is a local legend. He is 20-time Emmy Award-winning chief meteorologist, climate change expert. He's spent the last 25 years on Denver 7. This is Mr. Mike Nelson. How are you today, sir?
I'm good, Joe, and I will apologize right from the get-go that I'm also a dog lover. I'm not apologizing for that. But my two dogs are just upstairs barking, and so we may have some guest appearances coming on this broadcast.
That's funny, because I have my puggle, Bowser, who's an old lady now. She's just turned 13 in May, and she has that pug feature where she... Yeah. So I actually had to relocate her from my office today to put her out in the guest room. So otherwise you'd be hearing a little chainsaw effect the whole time we were talking today. So no judgment here. We do love our dogs. So we'll have to make that a whole nother episode.
Right.
But I appreciate you taking some time this morning to talk to us. Those of you who have been following The Measuring Post know that this is a place to learn and grow together. We've been going through some different individuals' heartfelt stories about struggles they've been facing. But today we're going to do a little bit different of approach, because part of being a good person and learning and growing, it's also about taking care of where we live. And that, of course, is Mother Earth. And there's things we're going to learn today from Mike, who's an expert in this field, that I think we can all learn from and obviously try to translate to our daily lives and be better stewards of the earth. So with that in mind and kind of the warm lead-in, I'd like to discuss a little bit about your history, Mike. So what kind of got you started in meteorology? Was there like an event or something you saw, an asteroid shower or something that really sparked your interest? And kind of how did you grow into the role you're in now?
Joe, I've been a weather nut since I was a little kid. And I remember it vividly. I was about 6 years old, growing up in Madison, Wisconsin, and we had a severe thunderstorm move into the city. And it came in with tornado warnings and flash floods and large hail and trees knocked down. We had to go down into the basement. And where some kids might have been afraid, I was absolutely fascinated by it. I thought it was the neatest thing in the world, and I kept waiting for the next one. My mother would tell stories of waking up with a lightning storm in the middle of the night, 2 a.m., and coming downstairs and checking in my bedroom and seeing I wasn't there, and coming out, and I was standing out in the front yard underneath the awning watching the lightning, and she'd, you know, yell at me to get back in the house. It's been going on since I was in first grade. And I've always wanted to be a meteorologist. I built a little home weather station as a child and kept daily weather records. And so this has been going on for over 60 years now. When I was in high school, I was president of the weather club. Not that there was a big weather club. There was me and two other people. And I worked at a Baskin-Robbins ice cream store, and the local TV weatherman, a gentleman named Terry Kelly, used to come into my shop to get ice cream in between the 6 o'clock and the 10 o'clock newscasts. And for me, this was like a football star coming in to my ice cream store. And I'd always be the one to serve him, and I'd ask him weather-related questions about the possibility of snow or whatever. And my father finally said to me, "Why don't you ask this guy for a job? You don't have to get paid, but, you know, go out and empty his wastebaskets, answer his phone." And so I did, and lo and behold, he hired me. So when I was 18 years old, I got my first job in TV. He did pay me, paid me minimum wage, and I began to do just odd jobs around the TV station and gradually made the maps and the forecasts. And so by the time I was a senior in college at the University of Wisconsin, getting my degree in meteorology, I was already on TV doing the weather.
That's cool. That's a cool organic story. I think it's always fun to see somebody that has that passion that was instilled in them at such a young age. And then here you are, you're an adult, entire adult working life. You've done this, and it's been something that, you know, I've had the pleasure of getting to spend time with you outside of your role on TV in this interview. And you are such a knowledgeable but passionate man about it. And it's inspiring, really, because it's rare to find somebody that finds something that they stick with that long and still really love and believe what they're doing is so important. So that in itself is really cool.
Years, I'd be better.
No, you're too humble, Mike. You're very, very talented. 20-time Emmy Award winner. I did throw that in there. So yeah. I think I'm not the only one that agrees that you're fantastic at what you do. And so that kind of leads me to something I wanted to get at. When you first started way back, you know, helping Terry Kelly out, I'm sure that the technology and everything was extremely antiquated to today's setup. So can it kind of go through like just the years of how technology is adapted and how that's helped you kind of learn and be better at what you do?
When I started, and the first TV station I worked at was the ABC affiliate in Madison, Wisconsin, which had the great call sign of WKOW, WCOW in the dairy state. And we literally did the weather the same way it had been done since the 1950s. We had magic markers and magnetic suns and clouds and things, and we would put that on a pull-up weather board, and they'd shoot us with a camera to be on TV. And we began to try and invent newer ways to do things. So we created these hand-drawn weather maps that we would get cut out plastic lettering to put cold and hot and things on. And we had this little film called, I can't even remember what the name. It was plastic film that you could cut out cloud shapes and stuff with an X-Acto knife and apply that onto the map. Zippitone, that's what it was called, Zippitone. And it had different colors of orange and green and blue, so you could overlay these to put like different layers of cold air, warm air. It took hours to make these weather maps, and we literally would then tape the maps onto the wall of the studio with a couple of pieces of masking tape, and you'd have this whole line of maybe 7 or 8 maps in a row, and the cameraman would pan the camera across this row of maps as you gave him verbal cues. You'd say, you know, the high temperatures today were really impressive, but let's take a look at what the lows are going to be tonight. And hopefully the cameraman would get that cue to pan to the map that would be the predicted lows for the night. And then you'd say, and the jet stream is going to be really important for our weekend forecast. And he'd pan to the next map, which was the map of the jet stream. Well, not only did it take hours to make all these maps, but there were technical difficulties, like if he didn't get your cue, he's still on the same map. You have to say, you know, let's take a look at that jet stream. And hopefully he'd go, oh, I need to pan to the jet stream. Or finally, you have to say, hey, Bob, the cameraman, would you move to the jet stream map? And so it lent itself to not being very smooth on the air. And there were also two other things that had happened. Sometimes the masking tape would let go, and so the map that you were referring to would suddenly go kind of sideways and then fall on the floor, and all you'd see is the brick wall of the studio behind you. Or, more importantly, these maps were only about maybe 8 by 10, and so when they were shot with the camera, they'd blow them up much bigger. Well, one time in the middle of the show, a fly landed on the map and started walking across the map. And the fly was the size of a hamster. I mean, it was really big and kind of creepy. It looked like the fly that ate Kansas or something. So about 45 years ago, it was the late 1970s, we're still doing the weather in the traditional way. And Terry Kelly, my boss, had some good friends that worked at the Space Science and Engineering Center at the University of Wisconsin that were working with mainframe computers to develop some of the earliest overlaying technology for putting fields of weather, wind fields, temperature profiles, on top of satellite imagery. And this took millions of dollars of mainframe computers to do this at the time. But we realized computers are the way to go as far as weather graphic presentation. And we knew TV stations would never spend millions of dollars on a weather presentation system, but we took an Apple II home computer and developed the very first technology to overlay weather information on a computer presentation. And so in 1979, we started developing the very first TV weather computer system and using it at little WKOW TV station in Madison, Wisconsin. So 45 years ago is when we started the first computer weather graphics system. And I'll tell you more of that story. It became a business called Weather Central. And my job was to travel around the country and install these weather computer systems at TV stations. Our first system, we had it for sale for $15,000. And this was at a time that when you'd bring a computer into a TV station, that was the first computer in the entire building. So everybody would come down to see it. The salespeople and the management, you'd get a big crowd around you in the studio as you're training the weathercaster how to use this computer system. I trained Al Roker on his very first weather computer. And for those of you listening in the Denver area that are people of a certain age, I brought the first weather computer system to Denver in 1982 and trained the legendary Stormy Rotman on his very first weather computer, along with my dear friend Bill Custer over then at KBTV. That was Channel 9 before it was KUSA.
That's outstanding. I did not know that you were so involved in the development of that. That's pretty cool. And, you know, back in the early 2000s, I went to media school. I went to the Ohio Center for Broadcasting, which is now Colorado Media School. And that was kind of my interest getting into radio. But part of that was learning the green screen technology of the weather, you know, the weather system. So I don't know how much of what you developed back then translated to that, but I thought it was extremely difficult to be on the green screen. My head kept coming in and out of frame. My hands weren't doing what I thought they should be doing. And that in itself, definitely, I'm sure, takes a little bit of getting used to.
It is a bit like patting your head and rubbing your stomach at the same time, because you're pointing at something that's not really there while you're trying to refer to the camera, and everything's kind of backwards from what you're used to. I've been doing it so long that if I now, with these huge monitor systems that we have at TV stations, they're kind of going back to having just the map behind you like I used to do in the mid-1970s, and it's actually harder for me to know how to point and not be in the way of the camera and everything else than it is to just do the chroma key.
Yeah, I guess that would certainly be frustrating to full circle back to where you started from and have to relearn the old ways again, even though you're using the new technology to do it. But yeah, I think that's really cool. And you know, the advances in technology, I'm sure, have also really helped you, not only individually, but as, you know, a collective, the meteorological societies, on things like climate change and your ability to see what's really happening in the world and what's happening in the oceans and things. So obviously you're a very big proponent for, you know, being better to the earth and climate change in general. You've actually written a couple of local bestsellers, the Colorado Weather Book, also the Colorado Weather Almanac. And you also have the world's littlest book on climate. That's 10 facts in 10 minutes about CO2. So obviously at the end of this video, I'll put a link to those if anyone would like to read those. But with your work in climate change, kind of where do you see things going right now? And what do we need to do as a species to be better and kind of reverse some of this?
We are in a climate emergency. And so when we have political debates, I'm always encouraged when climate change is addressed during the debate. Sometimes I'm frustrated by some of the answers, but let me kind of put this all out in pretty simple terms. People will say to me, Mike, you've been a meteorologist for 60 years. You can't even forecast next week necessarily that well. How do you know what's going to happen next century? And the fact is, it's easier to predict climate than weather. Weather is fast changing and stormy and chaotic, and climate is a long-term average. So the analogy that I like to use is that weather is like one play in a football game. Climate is like the history of the National Football League. So you can look at trends and long-term changes. And the Earth's temperature is even more simple than that. It's heat in versus heat out. So global temperature is like the rules of the game. A touchdown is worth 6 points. A field goal is worth three. The field is 100 yards long. And the fact of the matter is, when we light oil, coal, or natural gas on fire, it produces heat. It also produces carbon dioxide. And that carbon dioxide goes into the atmosphere, and the little tiny molecules of CO2 are exquisitely good at trapping heat from escaping back into outer space. So the energy from the sun comes in as visible light, heats up the ground and the oceans, and then goes back out into space as infrared. And in that spectrum, carbon dioxide vibrates a little bit and redirects that heat so that rather than going back into space, it stays in the atmosphere, warming up the planet. And we are warming up the planet at an unprecedented rate, far faster than the changes that we've seen in the past, in and out of ice ages. And we are warming it up at a rate that will be about 5 degrees Fahrenheit by the end of this century from the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. What that means locally here in Denver, this year we had 6 days this summer that were 100 degrees or hotter. I know 30 plus years ago when I moved here, we used to maybe get one. And I remember when we bought our first house in 1991, the realtor said, "Do you want air conditioning? Because a lot of people don't have it." And they either just open the windows or they have a swamp cooler. Nobody anymore asks a new homeowner, "Do you want air conditioning in Denver, Colorado?" We all get air conditioning. We now have about 5 or 6 days over 100. By 2060, unless we make carbon cuts, change the way we power our world, we'll be looking at 20 days of 100. And by the end of the century, 40 days of 100 degree temperature in Denver every single year. That will be the normal.
Yeah, and that's daunting to think about. It's, you know, it seems like it's so far off into the distant future, but it's clearly not. I mean, you know, in the blip of reality, that's just a microsecond in time. So definitely things that we need to do better. Now, what do you think are some steps that we can do, like the current population right now? Obviously switching things to electric is great, but then you hear the other side of the coin. Well, the mining of the cobalt and the things to make the batteries is bad for the earth. And there's always this, you know, kind of back and forth. So really, what do you think are some great things we can do, or even small steps we can take now to like make a big impact?
Well, there are some things that you can do. Obviously, plastic wastes is a big issue. There is a company that my wife and I use called Ridwell. And we have a little box out front, like an old-fashioned milk box, that we can put our single-layer and our multi-layer plastic in, and every 2 weeks they come and pick it up. So we recycle all of our plastic waste. They also do batteries and light bulbs and other features. I got rid of a whole bunch of old skis because Ridwell had a feature where they were going to take old skis and properly either recycle the materials or have them properly and as most environmentally sensitive as possible, recycle that information or put it into the landfills in the most responsible way. So Ridwell is something I highly recommend. We can all make better choices as far as what we eat. I enjoy red meat and bacon as much as anybody else, but I can eat a little bit less of it. And that is a more sustainable process because it uses a tremendous amount of water and has a big carbon signature. As far as what we can do on a larger scale, not just personal virtue, because personal virtue is great, but this is going to take government scale projects to get things done. The two greatest American infrastructure projects that transformed our nation, didn't bankrupt us, made our world a whole lot better. In the 19th century, the Transcontinental Railroad. In the 20th century, the Interstate Highway Project. Both signed, by the way, by Republican presidents, Lincoln and Eisenhower. The next great project that we need is a super grid redoing our transmission system so that we can easily and efficiently move energy from source to need. It's always windy or sunny somewhere. And so a combination of solar energy, wind power, decarbonized natural gas as a backup that would run generators, and battery storage. We have the technology right now to do all of this, to run our grid on renewable energy. And the thing that we need is improving the grid, a super highway, if you will, for electricity all across the country. And we can do this. We would have it direct current. We'd bury a lot of the cable. It's more expensive, but it also reduces a couple of things. One, the NIMBY, if nobody likes to have transmission lines, overhead power lines in their view. But also, if we had a buried high voltage current transmission system, it would protect us from a threat from solar flares or from a terrorist attack that would be some rogue nation lights up a nuclear weapon high above Kansas, and the electromagnetic pulse it produces would completely shut down our grid. And this is a threat that might seem distant, but if our grid was to shut down, there was an event in the 19th century, massive solar flare called the Carrington event. Look it up, the Carrington event. And it caused the telegraph system across the country to basically short circuit. Telegraph offices caught on fire because the electricity induced in the telegraph lines was so great that it caused them to explode. Well, that shut down the telegraph system in the 1880s, I believe it was. Today, our entire system of life is so intertwined with transmission that if we shut down the transmission system, we would shut down all of the power, all of the banking, all of our economy, not for days, for months or years. Now, in 1880, people knew how to go hunt their own food. We're not too good at that anymore. This would put us back to primitive times. This is such an important thing to do to safeguard our lifestyle that we have to make the high voltage transmission system a top priority. And nobody's thinking about this, but it should be on the front page of every newspaper and on the top of every political leader's agenda.
Yeah, I mean, just the thought of being blown back to the Stone Age, I've read articles on that topic, and it does seem far-fetched, but realistically, it's not. It seems like it's very very much a possibility and a threat that should be taken more seriously. And you do hear some of the proposed ideas for like solar flares where, and it sounds like science fiction. I don't know if you think there's any sort of opportunity in this, but where scientists are talking about putting things out in the, you know, upper areas of our atmosphere that reflect the sunlight back and try to keep the heat from reaching Earth. And obviously that seems like that would be very expensive too, when we could use that money to rebuild our grid and infrastructure on Earth. But is that something you think would play any sort of viable solution, or is that kind of just, you know, a pipe dream?
Well, geoengineering is certainly something that is talked about a lot, and we are doing it obviously right now with the amount of carbon that we're pumping into the atmosphere every single day. We add right now 100 million tons of CO2 to the atmosphere every single day. So I'm going to first address carbon sequestration, which we hear about in the news, and it certainly is something we'll have to likely do to bring down the carbon in the atmosphere, but it's vastly expensive because the current target price, if we could do it, is $100 a ton. We're nowhere near that technology right now to put the carbon back in the atmosphere. But if you do the math, that means that just to put back into the ground what we put into the air every single day would be $10 billion a day globally. $3.65 trillion a year, not to lower the carbon dioxide, which we've increased by 50% in the atmosphere since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, but just to stay even. So if you want to know what the cost of carbon, call it a carbon tax or a carbon tariff, it's $10 billion a day or $3.65 trillion a year. It's a lot cheaper to just keep it in the ground. Now, it will be an investment to build this super grid, but it should be the infrastructure project of this century. This should be the goal of our country and the world, to decarbonize our economy.
Yeah, I you know, just hearing it, I wholeheartedly agree with you on that. And I guess that kind of leads me to another sort of angle on that topic. You know, we're talking about, this is a world problem. It's not just a U.S. problem. It's not just a Canada problem.
Carbon
molecules
are stupid. They don't know borders.
Exactly. Absolutely. So I guess that kind of leads to the angle of other countries that maybe aren't as developed or aren't as conscientious of this type of topic. You know, where do they fit in? Or you know, and a lot of these third world countries also are big polluters with their industrial age and things that go into their water systems and stuff. And how do you tackle this on a more global scale without just like the five handful of UN countries paying for everything and doing all the work?
Well, historically, the United States is by far the largest producer of carbon in the atmosphere. So I think there is a historical and a moral responsibility that we have. Now, that's not going to get very far in Washington, D.C., or with a lot of people, and for good reason. I mean, everybody's working hard, and we're all trying to just make our way. China right now is the largest producer of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, but per capita, per person, the United States still by far. However, a lot of people will say, you know, the third world deserves to realize their fossil fuels and develop their economies. To me, I think that's a little bit of a misleading argument, because that would say that the third world has to modernize the same way we did. So if you follow that line of reasoning, that means that the third world shouldn't be using cell phones. No. They have to do it our way. So they have to string up telephone wires and start with a dial-up phone and then gradually go to a touchstone phone, and eventually they can have cell phones. We can leapfrog technology. If you put renewable energy in a village in Africa, solar panels, you transform that village, because then they can have LED lights instead of burning a kerosene lamp. Then they can have refrigeration for vaccines and for food. Then they can have medications, because they can keep those medications from going bad because they can have refrigeration. You transform that village with a solar panel and a battery. They don't need to put up a coal-fired, locally produced energy source and run transmission lines. So we can do this differently with better technology. And the United States needs to be a leader in technological advances. We don't realize, when people say to me, well, what about China? Look up a couple of things. Look up CATL, which is a battery company in China, and the research that they are doing as far as batteries. We're looking at batteries that aren't necessarily using lithium and cobalt, but using iron and air. The world is a big ball of iron, and we have no shortage of air. Now, the technologies are going fast, and I think when people say, what about China, I'm looking at that saying, yeah, we better watch out, because they are going to be bypassing us quickly in terms of technology. They're already the leading supplier of solar panels to the world. There's a company called BYD, which is also worth a search online. Or just ask ChatGPT about BYD, and you'll get a whole lot in a big hurry. They are the biggest auto manufacturer in the world, ahead of Tesla. Now, you can't get these Chinese-made cars here, but they're huge in other countries, and they are coming out with high-quality cars that are getting 400 miles per charge on electricity, and they will cost somewhere in the neighborhood of $12,000 to $15,000. Now, a century ago, only rich people had automobiles until Henry Ford came out with the Model T and changed everything. That's what's happening right now with Chinese electric car manufacturers. And our manufacturers here are scared to death because they remember what happened with the Japanese cars in the 1970s, and it's about to happen again if our auto manufacturers don't get on the stick and come up with low-cost, high-quality electric cars.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the bigger frightening aspects of switching to electric for a lot of people. It is the financial investment. And obviously, that's something that we're going to all have to face at some point. And it's kind of funny, too, because even like, you know, we live around a couple of schools. My kids go to school out here, and every little kid is on an electric bike and an electric scooter. And, you know, I think the younger generations are going to just come into it, and it's not even going to be a thought process. But a lot of, you know, my generation and up to yours and beyond, it's that, well, I'm not turning in my gas car. I'm not going to spend 40 grand on this. And it's sort of that, you know, trying to change somebody's mind that, look, you might have to make a financial investment in it now, but the cost of not doing this is potentially the future of the planet. So, you know, pick your battles. Which one's more important to do? And obviously, we have to build the technology here first.
Yeah, the world will be a very different place in 2035. And if you think about how much money did you spend for your first computer, or I'll take it back even a step further, your first VCR, thousands of dollars. And now you can buy that stuff for, you know, nothing at all. It will be that way as far as electric vehicles. In 10 years, the technology, that next big leap in technology. So if we're getting 800 to 1,000 miles on a charge, and you can buy an electric vehicle for less money than a gasoline-powered car, it's going to be a game changer. And a lot of the pushback right now is the infrastructure's not there yet because we are in a transition time, but it will be there. And nobody that I've talked to that's tried an electric car said, you know, I tried driving an electric vehicle and it was just too quiet and it was just too fast and it didn't have enough moving parts to break down. That's, you know, that's what's going to happen. And yeah, there'll still be gas powered cars around, but the world is changing.
Yeah, you know, and even something you mentioned just briefly talking about putting something into ChatGPT, you know, as the world's changing and AI is evolving, we're seeing the huge demand on the energy infrastructure that AI is producing. I mean, Microsoft just paid billions of dollars to relaunch one of the nuclear facilities on Three Mile Island that had a partial meltdown in the 70s. So, you know, with that sort of technology that does not seem like it's going away anytime soon, in fact, that's going to become a lot of people's future is AI. How do we curb that drain on energy and sort of filter that into day-to-day life without consuming what little resources we do have?
Right, right. Well, the biggest solar field in the United States is under construction right now in California, out near Edwards Air Force Base, and it's called Bell Field, and it is being built by a company called AES, and it's being built for Amazon to power Amazon facilities. It will be over 8,000 football fields in size, and it's being built on land that is basically unproductive because it's too hot and it's too dry out there to grow anything. Well, let's talk about farming electricity. In California, the average cost of electricity is 35 cents a kilowatt. If you do the math, what that means is that an acre of land will produce $150,000 a year worth of electricity. Now, if you look at that as a crop, try talking into ChatGPT and asking him, what's an acre of corn worth, or an acre of soybeans, or an acre of alfalfa? And we're talking $500 to $1,000 for corn or soybeans, and about $2,000 for alfalfa per acre. So I can grow electricity for $150,000 an acre, Or here in Colorado, where the electricity is about half, that means $75,000 an acre. Or I could go to North Dakota, where the electricity is a third as expensive. That is still $50,000 an acre. If I'm a farmer or a rancher, wow, what a valuable crop I could grow without needing any more water than to wash the solar panels. And I can graze livestock under the solar panels, or I can grow certain crops under the solar panels. This is going to be a game changer if we can build the super grid to move the electricity from where it's being grown to market. It's the exact same thing as what transformed us in the 19th century with the railroad, and suddenly farmers and ranchers could get their crops or their cattle to market. And the same thing with the interstate highway system in the 20th century. The super grid will mean that the entire central part of the United States can become a massive energy producing area, because we'll be able to move the electricity from where it's grown, if you will, to where it's needed.
Yeah, that's actually an amazing idea. While we were sitting here and you were telling me that, I used ChatGPT. I'm actually, on this particular machine, I was using Claude, which is Anthropic's version. But anyways, I looked up, what is the acre value of 1 acre of corn? And although it can fluctuate widely, maybe only up to $1,000.
Yep.
So there's your math right there. That's a no-brainer if you're in the land business, or if you got the plot and you're thinking about what to grow. Maybe put up some solar panels, help the earth, put a little more money in your pocket, and obviously, hopefully jumpstart the need to rebuild our infrastructure to eliminate some of the problems that clearly we're heading into.
One of the most conservative states, Texas, is also one of the leaders in renewable energy, because these ranchers in West Texas realize, I put some wind turbines or some solar panels on my land, I can save my ranch.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems like there's going to be a lot of that going around, of how to, for lack of a better term, reinvent the wheel on what we're doing and how we're trying to make a living. And with the new need of not only energy, but resource depletion and climate change, there's things that have to change that are not only going to be beneficial for the earth, but for the individual. You're right. Like, my farm and ranch is going under, but if I can turn this into a renewable energy source, all of a sudden, you know, you get out of the red and back in the black, and things are looking good. And you're also doing a service to your community and the world in general. So I think that we're in a transition age, like you mentioned, but I like hearing from thought leaders like yourself and people in this sort of realm that you run with, the crew that you work with, because you guys are opening a lot of eyes to individuals like myself, who, it's not that I'm not a believer in climate change, or I don't think that we're doing bad. I just don't know that much about it. So it's nice to be informed and really kind of get some numbers and some calculations and timeframes that otherwise most people just kind of sweep under the rug because it's not affecting them right this moment. You know, they don't feel the burn today. So I appreciate you sharing all of that information and really your passion for the climate in general and how we can fix it. And, you know, I know that's something you talk about in your daily newscast and stuff as well at Denver 7, which you've been chief meteorologist since 2004. But that kind of segues into the next thing, because I know your time at Denver 7 is almost up. You've announced that you will officially be retiring in December. And what does that mean for Mike Nelson in 2025 and beyond?
Okay. Well, I picked 12/12/24 as the day for my last broadcast. And I came up with that because I liked the numbers. And if you add them up, they equal 48, which will be the number of years I've been in the business when I retire. So I thought it was an appropriate time. And when I retire, it will be the end of a long career in TV. I still enjoy weather very much, but I will enjoy sitting out on my back porch watching the clouds and the storms roll in, much like what brought me into that when I was 6 years old. And it's just time to pass the torch on to the next generation of broadcasters. We have a wonderful staff in the Weather Center at Denver 7 that I will leave the clicker the little device that changes the weather maps over to them, like passing the baton. What I will do in the future is continue in climate change education about the science and the solutions. I'm going to continue to do that all across the country. And my wife, Cindy, and I are also land bankers. And let me explain what we do. We have our real estate licenses, but we do not sell homes. We do not rent apartments or commercial space. We only deal in dirt. We sell land just ahead of development for investors to realize a wonderful return on investment. So whenever you're driving out somewhere and you see a new housing development, you wonder, wow, you know, whoever owned that land first made a lot of money. And that's what Cindy and I do. But a lot of it is not in housing, it's in renewable energy. So we are placing investors ahead of these new utility-scale solar developments that are occurring, and they can make a wonderful return on investment. Why? Because, as I mentioned, in California, where we do our work, that land is worth $150,000 per acre per year to the solar companies. And so if I own that acre of land first, they're willing to pay a pretty good amount of money to get that land, because without the land, they can't put their solar farm in.
Yeah, that's awesome. I know that you've been working that angle for the number of years now, and I love the idea of it. And obviously, I would like to share that information. Now, are you and Cindy in a position where you take on new clients and you help them, you know, kind of through the process?
Yes, absolutely. And we are MNC Land Specialists. So our website will be mncland.com. We're working on that right at the moment. If you go there now, we have the domain, but there's nothing there.
But that's no worries. I'll definitely add that link to this video as well, so people can find you, and we'll be pushing that information out. And I wanted to make one more quick note I forgot to bring up, because I think this is really cool. You talked about wanting to continue educating for climate change. You do a lot of that now with going to local clubs and schools and teaching children. And I think that's a really cool thing just to mention, that I appreciate you do that. You go to over 50 schools almost every year to talk to grade school level children on the importance of this topic. So I commend you on that. I think it's great to teach the young generations, and obviously they're going to be the stewards of the earth long after we're gone. And it's important to set them up in the right way.
Well, I have, over the course of my 48 years, spoken to over 1 million children about weather and climate. And one of my favorite stories related to that is, I was about 5 years ago out at Lockheed Martin and doing a story about the new weather satellite that they were building at their facility out there. So I'm standing in the clean room, and I have my microphone, and I'm doing my story. And about 200 feet behind me is the satellite, with all of these technicians in their white clean suits working on it. And I finished my story, and about six of them were right behind me. And they said, Mr. Nelson, could we take a selfie with you? And I said, yeah, sure. Why? And they said, you totally came to our grade schools when we were little kids. And I'm thinking, and now they are building stuff that's going into space. And I thought, that is so cool. I don't know that, you know, my visit to their school was necessarily the complete inspiration to go into science and technology, but it had a part. And all of those school kids are the people that are going to grow up to be the inventors and the business leaders and the political leaders that are going to transform our world. And so I hope that perhaps I play a small role in inspiring them.
Yeah, I think that's a beautiful story. And it just shows, you know, when you plant that seed in someone's mind at a certain age, it can grow into something that turns out to benefit the whole world. So that's a really cool story. And honestly, I think a nice point where we can wrap that up and say, you know, I think what we can take from this conversation is that we need to do the things now that are necessary to survive a total climate meltdown. We have to take the steps, build the infrastructure, recycle, be better stewards individually, but as a community, and as, like you mentioned, on a government level and on a nationwide level. So I think that's definitely what I've learned today from this conversation, and certainly something that has opened my eyes that I'll be passing on this information, this video, this interview, and really all the work you guys do is so important. So I really appreciate you taking the time and sharing that with us today.
Joe, it's been a pleasure. If I can say one thing, you know, recycling is great and living a little bit more environmentally friendly lifestyle is great, but one of the most important things you can do is vote.
Absolutely.
That's one thing we all have the power to do. And regardless of how you see the world and how you all write in your vote at the ballot box, impress upon your political leaders that this is a topic that's very important. Because when people say, you know, climate change is way down on the list of what people are concerned about when we do our surveys, that is because they're not asking the right question. Because if you care about the border, if you care about the wars in other parts of the world, if you care about the economy, if you care about your children's future, you care about climate change because it's a threat multiplier for every one of those other issues.
I like that. And you're absolutely right. That's something that we all need to make a valid point of reaching out to your representatives, no matter what side of the fence you lean on or which way you're voting. Make sure that they understand that this is a topic that needs to be addressed. So I love that. And I think that's a brilliant piece of advice.
Thank you, Joe. It's been great talking with you.
Yeah, you as well, Mike. And again, looking forward to seeing the next adventure after 12/12/24. Obviously, we'll stay in touch and I'll share all your links to social media and to your land business when that website's up and running. And I look forward to seeing what you and Cindy do with renewable energy and helping the earth be a better place day by day. So thank you, sir, and appreciate your time on The Measuring Post.